Do you use an iPhone or an iPod Touch? Do you listen to Deconstructing Dinner? Deconstructing Dinner is happy to announce our new iPhone and iPod Touch app, a new way to access our weekly episodes and bonus content direct from your iPhone. Check out the Deconstructing Dinner website for more information on how you can purchase our brand new app at www.deconstructingdinner.com.
From the studios of Kootenai Co-op Radio, this is Deconstructing Dinner.
And this is why we call ourselves eco-gastronomers.
Perché se è pur vero, come dicevo prima, che un gastronomo che non è ambientalista è stupido, è altrettanto vero che un ambientalista che non è gastronomo è triste.
If I was saying before that a gastronomer who's not an environmentalist is stupid or an idiot, I also would like to say that an environmentalist who's not a gastronomer is also very sad.
This is Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated weekly radio show and podcast out of Nelson, British Columbia's Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY. I'm John Steinman, and you just heard a clip of Carlo Petrini, the founder and international president of Slow Food, a global organization whose mission is to work to defend biodiversity in our food supply, spread taste education, and connect producers of excellent foods. We'll be hearing more of Carlo Petrini in the second half of today's one-hour episode, when we'll also hear from Slow Food Canada's international representative, Sinclair Phillip. But Sinclair will also be our featured guest for the first half of today's broadcast, which will also mark part 7 of our ongoing series, Conscientious Cooks. Sinclair is the co-owner of the well-established and very well-known Souk Harbour House, a 28-room inn in Souk, British Columbia, that is also home to a restaurant that has led the way in Canada, if not North America, in the practice of sourcing local and wild foods. The restaurant even goes so far as to cultivate their own herbs and salad greens right on the property, thanks to the property's gardener, Byron Cook, who we'll also hear from today. And this year, the Souk Harbour House will also be employing Jill Wynn Stanley, a young Souk farmer who will farm specifically for the restaurant on land that the hotel is leasing only blocks away from the property. For the Souk Harbour House, sourcing local is most importantly about sourcing the tastiest and most pleasurable foods, which in turn supports the local agricultural and food economy and decreases the restaurant's environmental footprint. We'll also meet some of those locals who supply the restaurant with fresh foods, such as Mary Alice Johnson of ALM Organic Farm and Amy Rubbage of Barefoot Farm. And again, in the second half of the show, an inspiring talk delivered by Slow Food founder Carlo Petrini, and Sinclair Phillip will also weigh in with his perspectives on the Slow Food organization in Canada and abroad. As part of our February 25th episode, we heard from a number of residents of Souk, British Columbia, a small community about a 45-minute drive from the city of Victoria on Vancouver Island. Those voices included Diane Bernard of Outer Coast Seaweeds and Pia Carroll and Marion French of the Edward Milne Community School's Culinary Arts Program. All three of them have close connections with the most well-known restaurant in the area, the Souk Harbour House, an inn and restaurant that has become an incubator for a vibrant food culture in the area since Sinclair and Frederic Phillip purchased the property in 1979. The restaurant has also since become a place of employment over the past 20-plus years for some of Canada's most reputable chefs, some of whom have even been featured here on Deconstructing Dinner. Our ongoing Conscientious Cooks series has met with and heard from chefs from throughout North America, and while Sinclair Phillip is not the chef at the Souk Harbour House, it's been his and his wife and partner Frederic's passion for good food that has placed the Souk Harbour House as a leader in North America for demonstrating the capacity with which restaurants can cultivate healthier food economies and more vibrant local food cultures. I sat down with Sinclair in February 2010 while touring through the area, and I didn't say no to an offer to first enjoy a glass of sparkling wine while chatting about the restaurant's philosophy, its challenges, and its future. The wine was from the nearby Venturi Schultz Winery in the Cowichan Valley, and it went perfectly alongside the warm fire that we sat beside in the inn's garden room. Here's Sinclair Phillip introducing the Souk Harbor House and the area's agricultural and once vibrant seafood history.
We're in a kind of an ideal location on Whivens Spit, and this area was only discovered a little over 155 years ago in the mid-1800s, and we're on Whivens Spit, which is named after the chief petty officer who surveyed this particular area on the British ship that rediscovered it after the Spanish. And this was a very important summering grounds for the First Nations people of this area, the traditional Sioux band. Fishing has been very important on this particular location where Souk Harbor House. We've had fish traps across the bay. We had a shark rendering plant that rendered salmon oil, which is popular today, but it's been around for a long time, and shark oil. And the people who started this place, his name was Anthony Cahoot, and his wife was Natalie, an American woman, and they started this place in the 20s, and for a while it was a summer camp. And then after that, they built the Souk Harbor House dining room that we are going to eat in a little while, and built a small hotel here. But they had communal kitchens. The whole place was a farm. It covered most of the neighborhood. And the owner, strangely enough, so that there's some lineage here, was the president of the Souk Farmers Institute while he was here. And there's a lot of farming. And that was carried on in the post-war period by the LaVertue family that lived here for quite a long period of time and were famous for their farm products and local meats.
Sinclair Phillip is obviously passionate about food, and for him, the idea of eating as close to home as possible began as a child in what is now Cambridge, Ontario. While Sinclair's reflection on his childhood is one of seemingly abundant local foods, as we know all too well here on Deconstructing Dinner, access to such foods and such a culture is quite a challenge today in the shadows of a global food system. Sinclair speaks of those challenges and his wife's efforts to introduce unique foods to the area when they arrived in 1979.
My grandfather had very large kitchen gardens in downtown what is now Cambridge, which was then Galt, and they had a summer kitchen where they preserved all their own food, and they ate extremely well. You actually had very large flower gardens. This is in the middle of a thriving town, but he thought it was important enough that he would continue on that tradition, and he bought a lot from Portuguese butchers and Italians and people who had excellent confectionery goods and hang meat for them and that sort of thing. And my grandfather on my mother's side ate a lot of wild fish and was good friends with the commercial fishermen in Ontario, the Oldfield family, and the First Nations people who were good friends of his, brought him meat and a whole lot of different wild foods. And so I was brought up to a degree on those sorts of foods, and my mother was a very good gardener and an excellent cook. And from Canada, I went to France and lived in a very small valley for 10 years, where people really, almost entirely, only ate local food. And they didn't eat local food because it was sustainable. They ate local food because that's what you eat in most parts of the world. Most people in the world today have barely moved away from where they were initially brought up. And about half the world's population is made up of farmers still today. So these people ate food from their own communities, because it was part of their cuisine. These are recognizable dishes that everybody could produce, that tasted very good, that were cooked with the very best ingredients. So food was about culture and enjoyment. It was the key point of every day. It was the main period of relaxation, and it was a time for chat. And so most of your meals took place in your immediate family or in a larger family, because people often had people over, extended members of the family or other friends. So it was the main point of social expression and enjoyment and pleasure within the day. When we arrived in Souk, there were quite a few farms. Almost all of those farms are gone today, because we had the largest rate of agricultural land removal in the province in Souk under the encouragement of our town, both before but particularly after incorporation. So we've lost most of those farms. We also had a very big fishing fleet at that time. But unfortunately, due to the fact that we have the most heavily dragged area perhaps in the world in the Strait of Juan de Fuca, we no longer have most of the bottom fish we once had. Souk was known for its fish traps, and there's a wonderful display of all these fish traps in our local museum. And we've gone from having an abundance and actually millions of dollars been made by a few local people to the point where it's hard to get any fresh fish. When we first arrived in Souk, about, I would say, 20 to 30% of all the fish we got in the fish and also shellfish we got in the kitchen were alive. and now it's hard to get anything and it's certainly hard to get things as fresh because of all the new technical requirements. All the shellfish go to Nanaimo for testing and then pretty well have to come back frozen, so we can't get them. Abalone is extinct. We first got it at $2 a pound and then got it at $4, and then the price kept going up. So we were able to get a wide variety of things, and we also worked with commercial fishermen that had sea licenses at that time. So there's some day boats, so it was a much shorter term fishery without these huge factory ships that are going out that dominate our industry today. And we were able to go out scuba diving as assistants, and we'd get a certain percentage of the catch when we went out, or we would exchange with local fishermen because there were so many here, and if they went off for a week or two at a time, the fishermen would come back and want to spend a night in the hotel or have a meal with their wives because they hadn't seen them for so long. So we had a very direct relationship with those fishermen. Today there are practically none left. There are very few fish, and we still get local crab. Our next door neighbors are crab fishermen. We get local shrimp, and we still buy from some of our original suppliers, such as Gordy Hohort, who was here 31 years ago when we started, and a handful of other people. But most of that fishery is gone, and the direct relationships are increasingly disappearing.
That's Sinclair Phillip of the Souk Harbor House, and this is Deconstructing Dinner. The Souk Harbor House is an established 28-room inn in the community of Souk, British Columbia, on Vancouver Island. The property is home to a restaurant that is the feature of today's first half of the show in part 7 of our ongoing Conscientious Cooks series. The restaurant has, over the past 20-plus years, led the way among North American restaurants who seek to source most of their ingredients from the local community, which for the Souk Harbor House also involves sourcing from the property itself. But despite the efforts of the restaurant, there are and have been, as Sinclair outlines, many challenges to carry out this local philosophy. For one, and as has been discussed at length here on the show, British Columbia is still struggling with new meat inspection regulations that have forced many small-scale livestock producers and slaughterhouses out of business. Along with the seafood challenges also mentioned, this too creates for a lot of work for restaurants like the Souk Harbor House to source local product.
We've always put a lot of energy into it, and it's probably no more difficult today, although it's going to become, I think, in the near future, more difficult to source locally. But I'm encouraged by a number of recent evolutions that I've been able to follow. But I think it's always been somewhat difficult, and we've always had to make a real effort. But we've never tried to be sustainable. It hasn't been our goal to be locavores. I don't like the term, or sustainable. Our idea has always been that local culture involves local food. It's a representation of your area. It's the healthiest food. It doesn't travel long distance. And you can develop an understanding, and through that understanding, you can cook much better with it. And you share the pleasure not only with the people around your table, but also with the community that supplies you with those foods. So it's more of a question of pleasure and food culture than it is really being sustainable. It's just coincidental that it's sustainable. But the best foods in the world are always local foods. If you go to Japan, it's extremely local. I have dinner with a chef in Italy, and they won't really buy most of their ingredients from more than 50 kilometers away. In England, the definition of local through Soils Association is within a 50-kilometer radius. So this is something that is traditional everywhere, in my opinion, where they eat really well. It's never been fusion. It's always been the foods of that area well understood, and that's all we've tried to do, increase pleasure through eating local food and working with local people we enjoy. We have every confidence in our food because most of the food that comes through our door, not all, because we do buy some field crops and things from further away, but try to buy locally as much as possible. We know the people behind it. We've seen their operations. We know what their farm looks like. We know how they treat their animals, which is very important. I can give you the name of one of the happiest farms in the world, Lucinda Fothergill, for instance. I've never seen such happy animals. They all come up to you. They're all very friendly. None of the animals are afraid. You can see how these people's animals are treated, and it gives you a very good feeling about animal husbandry, about the mentality of the person, and also whether or not you're really honestly getting the kind of food that you want to feed your kids or eat yourself or feed your restaurant customers, such as we do at Souk Harbor House.
Surrounding the property of the Souk Harbor House are well over a dozen uniquely constructed and permanent hoop houses to permit for year-round growing of fresh herbs and salad greens, all of which are certified organic. Managing the gardens is Byron Cook, and when I first arrived on the property, I was greeted by Byron, who was holding a bowl of freshly picked stinging nettle, an edible and wild plant native to North America. It was quite a surprise to see stinging nettle so early in the season, February 15th. And while southern Vancouver Island has the longest growing season of anywhere in the country, even that is unusually early for stinging nettle. Lucky for me, that bowl of stinging nettle became the first course of my dinner later that evening, which was prepared by the kitchen staff of head chef Sam Benedetto. Here's Byron Cook introducing us to the Souk Harbor House Gardens.
We have a garden here that has been certified organic for the last 8 years. It's been organic since The present owners bought it 30 years ago and probably organic before that. We've always done things organically, and we only grow food that you can, I mean, only plants that you can eat. It's a completely edible garden. So we have about 300 different plants during the year that we harvest, and we harvest them for the kitchen.
Okay. And do you have a team of people you work with, or are you more or less the team?
Well, right now, at this time of the year, I'm the team, but we will have more people in the summertime, and we have an auxiliary team at a farm that we've got about a four-minute walk from here. We'll have two greenhouses now, and we'll have another greenhouse plus some field crops, which will be the first time we've ever been able to do that here, like actually growing carrots or potatoes or squash or things like that, which we simply don't have room for. And of course, there's the deer problem.
Mm-hmm. So here we are in the middle of February. Most people who live in Canada or outside of Canada wouldn't imagine there is much food growing here. Is there anything right here that's being produced as we speak in this garden?
Well, all of our salad greens right now, and probably 15 to 20 things I pick for a salad every day. Some of them in small quantities, some of them in large quantities. And some of them are plants which are indigenous. Some of them are introduced weeds. Some of them are just plain old ordinary lettuce.
Mm-hmm. So you have a very close connection with the kitchen. So are you essentially bringing in whatever it is that's available? Or are they working with you as to what they need? Or?
Well, they have a list in there, and they write down what they want, and I go out and get it.
Okay.
And if I have something that I think they might be interested in, like stinging nettles, which I was just picking, I guess 2 weeks ago we picked the first ones, and they didn't know they were there. So I picked a bunch and brought them in, and they were excited. That's the way it works. Either they tell me what they want, or I suggest things that I've got.
Are things like stinging nettles usually ready at this time of the season, or is this a little early?
It's a little early. We had one good cold spell in early December, which set things back. But since then, it's been a fairly mild winter.
Byron Cook mentioned the farm that the Souk Harbor House will be sourcing some of their produce from this year. It's a 1.5-acre property that the inn has leased for years. But this year, it plans to ramp up production with the help of area farmer Jill Wynn Stanley, who has also planted many berry bushes on the property as well. It's yet another example of the intensive approach to controlling the source of the food entering into the Souk Harbor House kitchen. There are very few restaurants in the country who maintain their own farm and farmer. With the winter season in effect, we didn't visit the farm, but gardener Byron Cook was not without a wealth of options to demonstrate some of the unique winter foods ending up on the restaurant's menu.
The deer fencing, that has become a critical thing around here because the deer problem is just enormous. We put these up last year. What we have in here is mainly salad greens, but some native plants also. Tulips. If the tulips were outside, there wouldn't be any tulips to see. And actually some buds on some of them. So that's pretty early. Usually it would be mid-March before you start seeing buds on tulips.
Okay.
But we have a lot of miner's lettuce, which is self-seeded everywhere. It's a native plant, grows from Alaska to Northern California. It's an excellent winter salad green. We will not grow in the wintertime. Simply won't grow.
Also known as Claytonia?
Is that
the same?
Well, Claytonia, Montia, same thing. We call it miner's lettuce because that just it theoretically came from the fact that the miners, gold miners in Alaska, this was the first green thing they saw in the spring. But we have some arugula here. We have some chervil growing back over here. Chervil is an excellent winter green for us, and herb. The arugula, the parsley, cilantro all grow better in the wintertime here. And cool weather crops, as is lettuce. I mean, it grows better in the wintertime.
And over here you have some, it seems, permanent hoop house arrangement.
Yeah, these are here for most of the winter. I'm kind of thinking about I might take them off early this year because they were at one time not only to keep the rain off, but to keep the deer out. And since we have this inside the fence now, I can take them off a little earlier, I think, because it makes it a lot easier to work from both sides of the bed rather than working from one side of the bed, which is difficult at any time. We're standing in front of a bed of nodding onion, which is a native onion, Allium cernuum, and you can taste it. It's a very strong flavor. Mm. We prefer to use the flowers and the bulbs themselves.
Mm.
You can see where somebody's cut some off. The deer started eating this last year. I'd never seen them do that before. I mean, it's a native plant. The deer and the nodding onion have been here a long time. I don't know whether they've been eating it all that time. Back over in here is some again, miner's lettuce everywhere. Some radishes here. We got another big bed of radishes over there. We're growing them for the leaves and for the flowers and the seed pods, mm-hmm. not for the radishes.
Right.
Hopefully with a new farm, we're going to be growing radishes to eat, too, as in addition to these. There's lots of really good recipes for using radish greens in Japanese cooking. Mm-hmm. And I've got a few from a Japanese farmer in Machozen, and I gave them the kitchen years ago. I don't know whether they've ever used them or not. They don't often ask me for them, but the flowers taste like radishes, and they're pretty. They're pink, usually.
Yep.
And so they're starting to bloom now, so it's a really nice early spring thing. And then when the flowers are finished, the seed pods come along, and they're nice and crunchy and taste like radishes.
Is being right beside the ocean here, does that really change the climate of this particular space versus, say, if you're a little more inland?
Oh, absolutely. It's much milder here in the wintertime, and it's much cooler in the summertime. So we're not going to be trying to grow tomatoes, basil, peppers, eggplant, things like that here. It's just not warm enough. Hopefully we're going to do a little better, you know, literally 200 meters inland. We're going to try things outside. We're going to try things in the greenhouse. We've grown tomatoes successfully, but it takes a lot of time and energy to grow them in a greenhouse. I mean, tying them up, and because they'll grow 10, 12 feet tall. Mm-hmm. And but it's really important to try to keep things in their proper season. I mean, we're not trying to grow tomatoes or peppers or anything like that or basil in the wintertime. We only try to grow those in the season where you'd normally expect to have them.
Has this become a model for any other restaurants in the area or restaurants outside of the area that are looking to really cultivating this type of connection with the food that's in the kitchen?
Well, I think all of them are using more local food, or trying to anyway. You have to have people producing the local food. And Sue Carver House has been instrumental in a lot of people getting into the business of growing food and selling it to restaurants. Most chefs that have worked here that have gone on to other places want to have their own farm, want to have their own garden. But it takes a commitment to do it, and it's a big commitment. Peter Zambri, one of our former chefs, has his own restaurant in Victoria. He wants my help in starting his own garden. It's very normal, and it sometimes works. With Peter, it'll probably work very well because he's an energetic guy, and we'll make it work. Mm-hmm. Okay. But everybody wants to do it. All chefs that deal with fresh herbs know they're better if they come out of your backyard rather than from California.
We've posted some images on the Deconstructing Dinner website which demonstrate the unique winter gardening setup on the Souk Harbor House property. Those photos are posted on the page for today's episode at deconstructingdinner.ca and the March 11th, 2010 episode. We've been hearing from Byron Cook, the head gardener at the Souk Harbor House, a 28-room inn and restaurant located in the small community of Souk on Vancouver Island, British Columbia. While a growing interest in local foods permeates much of North American culture today, the Souk Harbor House has been practicing a local philosophy for well over 20 years, certainly making it a leader in the country. The property's co-owner, Sinclair Phillip, is also passionate about wild foods and heritage foods, such as those which are part of Canada's Arc of Taste, a collection of foods that are unique to the country and which are promoted and celebrated through an initiative launched by the Slow Food Organization, an organization which we'll learn more about in just a moment. But one of the more unique wild-crafted foods used by the restaurant comes right from the property itself, Grand Fur. And here's Sinclair Phillips speaking about some of those wild foods used at the Souk Harbor House.
At Souk Harbor House, we've always, because we live in the country, worked with a lot of wild foods. And I think that the better restaurants in North America and also in the world that I've been to are in the country, not in the city. They're closer to an area of supply. If you go to the best restaurants in Italy, they're pretty well all in the country. Many of the famous restaurants in France are also in the country. Mm-hmm. Certainly it's the case with the restaurants of Japan. And when you live in the country, you're closer to wild foods and you're closer to farmers, so you have a very different understanding of what food is. And for us, wild foods have always been a very important component of what we do. So we worked with a phenomenal person. I would highly recommend all of her over 30 books, Dr. Nancy Turner, from the School of Environmental Studies. She is the chair, the dedicated chair in ethnobotany, and she's taught us a huge amount. Earlier today, we looked at our gardens, and we work with Grand Fur. And so many of the wild plants that we used to use, we don't always have time to go out into the woods to get them, so we've transplanted them here. So grand fir is a very good example of one wild plant that we use. We use western hemlock as a food. We use a number of First Nations foods, including camas, which we grow in the gardens that we don't harvest wild, and we wouldn't want to because those areas should be left untouched. We grow the native onion, Allium surnum, which is a very good wild plant. We grow quite a wide variety of traditional First Nations plants, including cows, parsnips. We collect all kinds of berries, and we work with the First Nations band in Sukhum. We have some very good suppliers of wild berries from the First Nations groupings around here. We have several good suppliers, and also we have local children who will go out and we'll put ads in the newspaper because we freeze a lot of our fruits for the winter or preserve them in different ways. So people will go out and harvest a wide variety of berries, First Nations plants, and other wild plants such as the oxeye daisy, which is probably a noxious weed that's been introduced into this region, and a whole variety of other greens that have become common throughout our countryside. We also have served, of course, many, probably the widest variety of seafood on the west coast of Canada in the earlier days, and developed an interest in a number of seafoods which sadly have practically disappeared from the marketplace. Either they're entirely exported to Japan and we don't get access to them, or they become extinct because of the drag fleet or because of overfishing. And we have always, since the day we opened our doors, been very interested in mushrooms. And we had the very good fortune of having a man who used to come to our door all the time, whose name is Michel Jean-Saint-Ainot, who is truly the number one expert in this area and can find a mushroom when nobody else can, and knows every spot far more than anybody else knows. And he came to our door repeatedly and sold us mushrooms. And he was a very good French professional waiter, perhaps the most professional waiter we've ever had. And one day we said, you know, you're always coming out here delivering chanterelles or matsutakis or different mushrooms. Why don't you come and work here? And he said, yes. So he came and worked here for about 20 years and did a phenomenal job and continued to sell us mushrooms. And he's no longer extremely young, although he seems as if he's 35 or 40, but he's still one of our biggest suppliers of mushrooms. So there's a very big network out here of wild foragers who bring us all kinds of things, from soap berries to what the people in Newfoundland call bake apples, to evergreen huckleberries, to red huckleberries, and wide variety of mushrooms. We employ a lot of people. They may be seasonal, but for these people, it's an important part of their year's income. People like Eric Whitehead, who's a very, very good expert mushroom supplier, comes here on a regular basis, makes his entire living from it, and so do people like Michael Scholey or Danusia Urbanski or a variety of other people. So mushrooms and wild foods are a very important part of our diet. And an important thing to remember is a lot of restaurants might have specials and they can incorporate these things into their menus, but what we've done is we have made it a habit of changing our menu every day. So if we only get six of one kind of fish, we'll put that on the menu, and when we run out, we have to serve something else. And it'll be the same thing if we get half a pound of chanterelles or matsutakis or lobster mushrooms or whatever it might be, or wild truffles. And now it's the season for wild truffles. Well, we'll only have them on for a day or two while they're fresh and while they're available. Mm-hmm. But they're always wild surprises. And I think of all the things which make food across our country interesting and characteristic, wild foods is probably the most important category.
Sinclair Phillip. Now, beyond the Souk Harbor House's gardens and farm and the efforts to source wild foods, the restaurant also, and not surprisingly, supports many farmers in the area. One of those farmers is Mary Alice Johnson, an experienced farmer, seed saver, and educator in the southern Vancouver Island food community. Along with Marika Nagasaka, Mary Alice operates ALM Organic Farm. From the farm, they also operate Full Circle Seeds, a producer of certified organic seeds for farmers and gardeners. Mary Alice is also involved in a number of unique educational programs, including apprenticeship programs such as SOIL, Soil, also known as Stewards of Irreplaceable Land. Sinclair Phillip joined me for a brief visit to ALM Farm to meet with Mary Alice Johnson, who at the time was taking care of a few rows of rhubarb that were just breaking through the soil surface.
I came to Souk to join my husband from Malaysia. I had met him there, and I was a teacher there, and I love Souk. And so we have a little house down the road, and we'll probably never move from there, but I had this little bundle of money, and I drove by this old farm. It's a 1910 farm, and I looked at it from the road, and it looked abandoned at that point. The roof was falling in. It was broom everywhere. We didn't even know we had an orchard until we started cutting the broom. So we bought it in 86. That was 2 years after I arrived in Canada. So I just took a summer off to work here. went down to the Harbor House and took him some things I was growing. I said, I like to grow strange things. I said, well, what's this and when do I harvest it? They said, well, that's tatsoi. You better wait a little bit until it's a little bigger. So because I have that teaching background, I guess I've always liked to have people come and work with me, and we've always had folks here working and developing that. So it's good for them and good for us. So we have a pretty serious apprenticeship program here. People come late February, early March, and stay to the end of October. And by the time they leave, they really can pretty much run the farm. We sort of give them responsibilities. Like last year, we gave Bill, he's from England, but he has a work visa here, and he's really interested in farming, and we gave him the job of connecting with the restaurants. Always Marika had done it. Marika, who's my partner now, she came as an apprentice 7 years ago, and about 3 years ago we got into profit sharing. But she always worked with the restaurants, and she's great. So she trained Bill to do that. One thing that's nice to say is it's all sold before it's picked, which is why we need new farmers. We don't need people to help us market particularly. We need more farmers in this area. So
we need more produce. I mean, here's a sad story. Sioux Harbor House has been buying for Mary Alice for 20 odd years. We've been good customers. And so I said to Mary Alice, could I get on your CSA program? And she said, you'll have to get in line with the others.
Right. So, yeah, we just don't have enough produce. And this farm it's an old farm. It was an old turnip farm. It's not particularly good agricultural land. It's full of rocks. It's not, hasn't got a real rich soil, but it produces really good food. And we bought a new property down there, 5 acres just south of us, and we've got pigs over there. We've got the Tom Henry's Berkshire pigs.
Can we buy some?
Sure. Yeah. That's Marika's project.
Okay.
So they'll
pop. We'd like to buy some.
And yeah, it's really good. Edward's been smoking it for us too, which is pretty good.
That's farmer Mary Alice Johnson of ALM Organic Farm in Sooke, British Columbia. As you could hear at the end there, the demand for local product by the Sooke Harbor House is rather ravenous, with Sinclair Phillips' clear eagerness to access the farm's soon-to-be-available Berkshire pork. Just down the road from ALM Organic Farm is yet another supplier of the Sooke Harbor House, Barefoot Farm, operated by Amy Rubbage. Amy currently focuses solely on egg production and is the restaurant's egg supplier.
And I'm actually in the process of just rotating my flock. I rotate them every year. Mm-hmm. So these girls are just at the end of their high production. They're 12 months, so they'll be replaced by some pullets mm-hmm. in the next month or so.
So what's the history of what you've been doing with chickens and eggs? Have you been doing this for a while?
About 3 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I bought the farm, and it actually came with 500 birds, but I backed it off to about 140.
Yep.
Just because it's a lot more manageable, both financially and work-wise. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of work involved with the chickens, mm-hmm. but it's basically the perfect livestock as an entry-level farmer to have mm-hmm. because it doesn't require a lot of responsibility. Yeah, I'm getting a few more birds in the next couple of months, but 140 at this time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So as far as making a business out of doing this, where do your eggs end up?
Well, they end up at the Harbor House, Red Barn Market, and the local grocery stores here in Sooke.
Amy Rubbage of Barefoot Farm in Sooke, British Columbia. The Sooke Harbor House clearly maintains a passion for supporting a local food economy in the Sooke region, and its over 20 years of experience doing so has provided dozens of chefs who have passed through the kitchen's doors with the inspiration to practice similar philosophies elsewhere. One of those chefs is Andrea Carlson, who we heard from years ago as part of this Conscientious Cooks series here on Deconstructing Dinner. Andrea was, at the time, the executive chef at Vancouver's Rain City Grill, but has since moved on to become the executive chef at Bishop's, another well-known Vancouver restaurant. You can learn more about the Sooke Harbor House on their website at sookeharborhouse.com or link to it from the Deconstructing Dinner site at deconstructingdinner.ca and our March 11th, 2010 episode, where today's broadcast is also archived. And be sure to check out our previous episodes of this Conscientious Cooks series that meets with chefs in restaurants from around North America who cultivate more personal relationships with the farmers and producers supplying them with food. And of course, I should also extend a big thanks to Chef Sam Benedetto and his team at the Souk Harbor House, who prepared what stands as one of the best meals that I've ever had, and all of it from ingredients sourced from either the property itself, the Souk area, or southern Vancouver Island.
Do you use an iPhone or an iPod Touch? Do you listen to Deconstructing Dinner? Deconstructing Dinner is happy to announce our new iPhone and iPod Touch app, a new way to access our weekly episodes and bonus content direct from your iPhone. Check out the Deconstructing Dinner website for more information on how you can purchase our brand new app at www.deconstructingdinner.com.
This is Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated weekly radio show and podcast produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY, in Nelson, British Columbia. I'm John Steinman. Now, our featured guest for today's broadcast has been Sinclair Phillip, who, along with his wife Frederique, own and operate the Souk Harbor House. But Sinclair is also involved with the international organization known as Slow Food. And I spoke with Sinclair about his involvement with the organization in Canada. But first, let's listen to an amazing talk delivered by Slow Food founder and international president Carlo Petrini. Carlo is from the Italian region of Bra and developed the organization in the 1980s after taking part in a campaign against fast food giant McDonald's, who was at the time opening a restaurant in Rome. Slow Food is a non-profit, eco-gastronomic, member-supported organization that was founded in 1989 to counteract fast food and fast life, the disappearance of local food traditions, and people's dwindling interest in the food they eat, where it comes from, how it tastes, and how our food choices affect the rest of the world. Slow Food has over 100,000 members in 132 countries. Here's Carlo Petrini speaking in November 2003 at the University of California at Berkeley.
Beh, io devo dire una cosa, che intervenire in un contesto di dibattito ecologico per un gastronomo è stato per tanto tempo impossibile.
I have to say something, that to be part of a discussion, an ecological discussion for a gastronomer, has been very difficult, impossible for a long, long time.
Perché per troppo tempo i gastronomi sono stati un po' orgogliosi di essere stupidi.
Because for too long, gastronomers have been too proud of being stupid.
Ora, io penso invece che la gastronomia debba uscire da questo limbo di stupidità generale.
And I believe that gastronomy should come out of this limbo of general stupidity.
Pieno di gente che spadella davanti alle televisioni, che presenta il cibo, che fa spettacolo sul cibo, e che è profondamente ignorante di come arriva il cibo sulla tavola.
People who play around with food in front of a TV set, who makes food into a spectacle, and people who are absolutely ignorant of how food arrives to the table.
Allora, ecco che il senso che Slow Food ha voluto dare nel liberare la gastronomia da questo contesto è di unirla fortemente al senso ambientalista, e quindi noi amiamo essere definiti eco-gastronomi.
And so in this sense, this is what Slow Food has tried to do, to free gastronomy from this context and to join it with the environmental sense. And this is why we call ourselves eco-gastronomers.
Perché se è pur vero, come dicevo prima, che un gastronomo che non è ambientalista è stupido, è altrettanto vero che un ambientalista che non è gastronomo è triste.
If I was saying before that a gastronomer who's not an environmentalist is a stupid or an idiot, I also would like to say that an environmentalist who's not a gastronomer is also very sad.
Ora, io penso che Nel il cibo è importante quasi come il linguaggio.
And I think that food is almost as important as language.
E dà il senso di identità più del linguaggio.
And it provides a sense of identity even more so than language.
Col linguaggio basta avere una traduttrice e risolto il problema.
With language, all you have to have is an interpreter and problem solved.
Con il cibo no.
Not so with food.
Con il cibo non è possibile perché il cibo è legato al nostro cordone ombelicale.
Not so with food because food is directly linked to our umbilical cord.
E non c'è neanche stato trasmesso da nostra mamma, ma da nostra nonna in genere.
And in general, this was not even something that came from our mothers, but generally from our grandmothers.
E quanto il cibo è importante per la storia, per l'identità di un popolo, per la salute psicologica della gente. Per la sua serenità è enorme questa importanza.
So therefore a food is very very important not only for history and the identity of people but the psychological health of people for their serenity. This is how important it is.
In qualche misura le similitudini col linguaggio ci sono perché se per la lingua cioè esiste l'alfabeto. L'alfabeto per il cibo è la materia prima.
And there are some similarities with language because, of course, we have the alphabet. And the alphabet for food, it's the raw matter, the basic ingredients.
La grammatica sono le ricette.
And grammar are the recipes.
La sintassi sono i menu.
And syntax becomes the menu.
E la retorica è la convivialità.
And the rhetoric is conviviality, sharing.
Ecco allora quanto è importante che il cibo sia determinante anche nelle battaglie che ci sono oggi in questa globalizzazione che tende sul cibo a distruggere un grande patrimonio gastronomico di biodiversità.
And therefore food is extremely important in today's battles, in the battles in globalization, because there is a tendency to fight a whole heritage and that is destroying also our biodiversity.
Porta all'appiattimento del gusto, alla non più una personalizzazione, un qualcosa che noi sentiamo profondo. Mangiamo tutti uguali, dappertutto.
It's the flattening, it's the evening out of taste. No longer this identity, this personal identity of personal flavor, but bringing everywhere everything the same, everything homogenized.
Allora se è vero che noi dobbiamo ricostruire questa identità, noi dobbiamo essere in prima linea in questa battaglia.
So if we have to recover this identity, we have to be in the front of this battle.
Con lo stesso orgoglio, con la stessa forza di un ambientalista.
And we have to have the same pride and the same strength as an environmentalist.
Coscienti che possiamo iniziare un processo di globalizzazione virtuosa.
And we have to become aware that we can start a process of globalization, but a virtuous globalization.
La globalizzazione ha un aspetto deleterio perché è l'ideologia dominante che ha imposto questa globalizzazione negativa.
And globalization has a deleterious and noxious effect because it's the dominating ideology that has exercised this very negative force.
E come dice il mio amico Edgar Morin, grande filosofo francese.
My friend Edgar Morin, a great French philosopher, says.
E anche socio di Slow Food.
And he's also a member of Slow Food.
Dice che c'è come un quadrimotore.
He says it's like four engines.
Che non riusciamo a fermare e che ci porta sul baratro, diritti verso il baratro.
But these are four engines that we cannot stop and that they're taking us directly into to death.
E questo quadrimotore è fatto da scienza, tecnologia, industria e profitto.
And these four engines are made up of science, technology, industry and profit.
Scienza riduzionista, che ha la verità, ha in sé la verità. La tecnologia che risolve tutti i problemi. L'industria che produce di più E il profitto alla fine è l'unica cosa vera.
And so science that believes that it has the truth, technology that produces everything, and then profit, of course, that think is the only true thing.
Allora la globalizzazione virtuosa è possibile. Ed è possibile da chi si oppone al quadrimotore.
And virtuous globalization is possible, and it is possible when someone opposes these four engines.
E ce ne sono tanti che si combattono il quadrimotore.
And there are so many people who are fighting these four engines.
Non solo quelli che vanno giustamente alle manifestazioni no global, ma anche quelli che si impegnano quotidianamente per rispondere e difendere la biodiversità.
And they're not just the people who go to demonstrations, but people who on a daily basis commit themselves to the defense of biodiversity.
Penso alla vita umile dimenticata di milioni di contadini del terzo mondo e anche di questo mondo.
And I'm thinking about the humble lives of forgotten peasants in the third world and also of this
sono
world.
Loro che combattono il quadrimotore.
They are the ones who are struggling and they're against
the four engines. Semplicemente aiutarli, scusa.
Vai.
Il tempo è tremendo.
Yes, and the only thing that we have to do is help them do this.
Io pensavo di tutto, ma a meno che il presidente di Slow Food fosse invitato a parlare fast.
I've thought about everything. I can imagine everything, but I never thought that the president of Slow Food was asked to talk fast.
Sono rispettoso, è un minuto, solo un minuto.
Oh yes, I'm respecting your timeline, yes, only 1 minute.
Allora la biodiversità, se non ha questa costruzione di soggetti che sono per il mondo.
If biodiversity does not have this structure of people that in favor of the world, that are working towards the world.
E questa alleanza che noi dobbiamo fare.
This is the alliance that we have to create.
Non è possibile fermare il quadrimotore.
Otherwise we will not be able to stop these four engines.
Allora noi dobbiamo lavorare quotidianamente per sostenere la biodiversità, per sviluppare il consenso, per fare in modo che ci sia più conoscenza e più educazione, molta, molta educazione.
So we have to work on a daily basis to preserve biodiversity, to develop consensus and to develop more than anything else education, education and education.
E lasciatemi dire che l'educazione c'è anche una componente sensoriale.
And I have to tell you that education has a sensory component as well.
Non c'è solo la componente intellettuale.
Not just the intellectual aspect.
Noi abbiamo una parte del cervello che la memoria gusto-olfattiva.
We have a part of the brain that has the taste and smell memory.
E costruiamo alcuni ragionamenti in base agli odori.
And we create thinking, arguments and thoughts on the basis of smells.
E allora bisogna aiutare i bambini a crescere con questa educazione dei profumi.
So we have to help children grow up with this education of smells.
Anche delle puzze.
Even bad smells.
Perché questa gente che fa 4 docce al giorno.
Because there are people who take 4 showers a day.
Non ha più le puzze per poter far l'amore.
So they no longer have the right smells to make love.
E avendo io chiedo scusa, ecco. Però
I apologize, I'm sorry.
Però io vorrei che questa sera, se andate via, vi sia rimasto questo piccolo senso dell'importanza della gastronomia.
What I would like is for you, when you go home tonight, that you have in your minds this small sense of what is gastronomy.
Ed è l'atto del mangiare.
And the action of eating.
E io la frase più bella che ho sentito nella mia vita l'ho sentita da quel signore che era che fa il contadino.
And the most beautiful sentence, the most beautiful phrase I've ever heard in my life, I heard it from that gentleman over there who's a farmer.
Lui ha detto che mangiare è un atto agricolo.
He said that eating is an agricultural event.
È fantastico.
And that's extraordinary.
Noi possiamo incidere sull'agricoltura mangiando bene.
We can have an influence and impact on agriculture if we eat well.
E avendo un buon rapporto con i contadini.
And having a good relationship with peasants.
Ma anche i contadini devono imparare a essere gastronomi.
But peasants as well need to learn to be gastronomers.
Allora io dico che coltivare deve essere innanzitutto un atto gastronomico.
So my statement is that cultivating is above all a gastronomic event.
E quindi avere a cuore anche il rapporto di chi dovrà mangiare questi suoi prodotti.
And to really keep in mind to have in their heart the knowledge of who's going to eat their product.
E come lo dovrà mangiare.
And the way they have to be consumed.
E quanto lo dovrà pagare.
And how much they should be paid for.
Ma questo ve lo racconterò un'altra volta.
But that is something else is for another time.
Grazie.
Thank you.
This is Deconstructing Dinner, and that was Carlo Petrini, the international president of the Slow Food Organization, speaking in 2003 at the University of California at Berkeley. Carlo's talk helps introduce my conversation with Sinclair Philip, who we heard from earlier. Sinclair is the co-owner of the Souk Harbor House in Souk, British Columbia, but is also the Canadian international representative to the Slow Food Organization. He's the past president of Slow Food Canada and is now a member of the Slow Food Vancouver Island Convivium. Both Sinclair and Chef Mara Jernigan, who's from the community of Duncan, British Columbia, were instrumental in forming Slow Food Canada. And Sinclair spoke to me about these beginnings after the two of them met Renato Sardo, the head of Slow Food International.
I've been interested in slow food for probably 15 or 20 years, and I decided to become more actively involved when I went to Cornucopia at Whistler in, I think it was 2000, and Renato Sardo and the then president of Slow Food USA were in attendance. We talked with Renato Sardo, and he suggested that we start developing more of a movement in Canada. And so with Mara Jernigan, who's now the president of Slow Food Canada, we set up the Vancouver Island Convivium. And we also started to develop an international organization to bring together the different convivia that are the local chapters in Canada together. And so I was the first acting president. I was the, they called them governors at that time. And this was a this was an elected position, but not elected by a national board or the national membership. There was a representation of all the convivia, that is the heads of convivia, who elected me, and I became the representative, and I've been the international representative of Slow Food since 2003 and will be the international representative until 2011. But I was acting president for the first several years, and now we actually have had elected presidents, and our current president is Mara Jernigan. Mm-hmm. It's easier for us to work together because we're both on Vancouver Island. Mm-hmm. But we are the largest food organization in Canada, as far as I know, with on an average about 1,200 members.
The Slow Food Organization is often misunderstood as simply a celebrator of good food, and while it definitely is that, it's also significantly invested in challenging the dominant fast culture of big, industrial, and global food. It recognizes all too well that to preserve and protect local food cultures around the world, a strong stand needs to be taken against all of these threats, and Sinclair Philip believes that the organization is the best one around who understands how to deal with these threats.
Slow Food is really, in some ways, philosophically anyway, the perfect organization that understands how these issues need to be dealt with, and Slow Food is often misunderstood. Slow Food is primarily about shortening the distances between supplier and producer supplier, producer, and consumer, and trying to get the consumer to work with the producer. It's a hard-to-understand concept that Slow Food has developed. So Slow Food is about buying directly from local people you know who produce what is called good food, that is food that tastes good, clean food, that is food that is safe for local consumption, and fair, and by that means fair to the people who are producing it, and also fair to the animals or the animals that they might be raising.
Since its inception in 1986 under the name Archigola, the Slow Food Organization has shifted from a focus on gastronomy to what Sinclair Philip describes as terra madre, the name of the biannual gathering that Slow Food hosts in Italy.
In the earlier phase, Slow Food was more about gastronomy, more about understanding artisanal foods. Artisanal foods of places like Italy and France are the ordinary everyday food of peasant farmers, small ranchers, and ordinary people. Those foods translated to North America become the luxury food of the elite because we don't have this tradition of the local farm relationship and these simple foods. So in the earlier days, Slow Food was partially identified with things like quality olive oil and Italian white wines and prosciutto and a variety of those different things. But very quickly it morphed or evolved into something which I think is much more valuable and has moved away from fancier dinners. And even though the appreciation of quality food and the education around quality food is very important, it's become more of an organization that is called Terra Madre and less of one which is called Saloni del Gusto, which is a food show for small peasant farmers and artisan food producers in Europe. Mm-hmm. Terra Madre is the meeting of primarily food producers, farmers, fishermen, ranchers, wild foragers, and secondarily university food specialists, chefs, and young people. And it's continuously developed into recently a meeting that counted over 5,000 representatives from Canada and many other parts of the world, and with observers up to about 8,000 people. It's going to become a bit smaller this year. But this is an opportunity, strangely, for people of like interests across the world to talk about raw milk, about slaughter facilities, about limitations on fisheries, about ethics, about genetically modified organisms, about global warming, the environment, a whole wide variety of different topics. And in Canada, because we haven't had very many organizations allowed, particularly producers, to meet together before, it seems odd, but many of the top producers in Canada and also the United States and many of the famous names have met in Italy rather than in Canada in their initial meetings and talked over the problems of our own country. So Canada might often have a delegation of between 120 to 200 people, so we have very large meetings in Italy and discuss our local problems because we all end up there. We're trying to change that a bit in that we meet more within Canada. We try and have our national meetings in different regional areas so that we can work more with local suppliers of various kinds and producers. And increasingly, instead of becoming an organization of consumers or gourmets, we're increasingly an organization that brings together the best producers in Canada with all the problems that they might have.
As my conversation with Sinclair Philip approached its close, I asked him what the most important shift he believes needs to take place in Canada in order to fully carry out the mission of the Slow Food Organization. From his food travels abroad and specifically in Europe, he believes Canadians should work towards the development of specifically defined regions of cuisine and food culture, something that is slowly beginning in Quebec.
An important thing that we need to start to understand is that in the countries in the world that are reputed for eating well, although many of those countries have their own challenges, in those countries they develop very narrowly defined regional food systems and cuisines. So in a country like Italy, we say, oh, well, Italian food is pizza or it's pasta with tomato sauce. It isn't. If you go to different parts of Italy, the food varies tremendously, not even regionally, but very locally. So each part of Italy will have its own type of pasta. They'll have a specific sauce. If you're away from the coast, you won't eat fish. If you're on the coast, you'll eat fish. If you're in the north, you'll eat bigger fish. If you're in the south, you'll eat fish fry. But you have these highly regionalized food cultures. It was the same thing in France. That's changing, unfortunately. On Japan, the food often doesn't come from more than 20 kilometers away. The fundamental thing that we need to try and understand in Canada is the development of local cuisines. And a local cuisine is something that is recognized from the outside. It's a repetition of specific recipes. Of course, you can vary them, but it may mean eating less of a variety of food, but understanding it better, understanding the production methods better, supporting local farmers, and eating better, in fact, because everybody can cook these dinners. You don't have to be reliant on going to a fast food outlet for your dinner. Everybody knows how to cook these meals. You spend more time eating throughout the day in most of these cultures. We spend very little time in Canada eating and preparing food. And you get much more enjoyment because you're around food and you spend a much longer period of time every day enjoying food with family or friends. And in France, they have an appellation system of over 500 different types of foodstuffs. And then within this appellation system, which they're just starting to develop in Quebec, you have a cooperative effort between different kinds of producers that set norms. They may be passed by law, but it's the producers, the artisan producers of these products, that set the norms and set the regulations that the others must abide by. It's a cooperative event. But then that means that specific types of rare breed animals, which are almost many of the rare breed animals are on the verge of extinction or will disappear, and we only really have a few types of beef or chickens or turkeys or a variety of other animals. This, in a country like France, this appellation system guarantees types of animal species, productive methods, areas that are set aside for the farming of these animals, the promotion and public relations and certification of those products. So you have this whole infrastructure that protects a whole wide variety of different regional foods. It's terrific. In Italy, you have the Indicazione Geografica Tipica, which are not as structured systems, and that's one of the reasons why Slow Food came into existence in Italy, because one of the sorts of things that the Presidia do in Slow Food, and the Presidia is part of Slow Food's ARC system, what they do is they set up structures that may provide technical skills or equipment or promotion or a variety of other things. What it sort of helps replace the French appellation system by setting up structures so that people can work together under specific norms. And that's precisely what they're doing in the appellation system in Quebec.
That was Sinclair Philip, the Canadian international representative to the Slow Food Organization. Sinclair is a past president of Slow Food Canada and is a member of Slow Food Vancouver Island. More information on the Slow Food Organization can be found at slowfood.org, Slow Food Canada at slowfood.ca, and Slow Food Vancouver Island at slowisland.ca. That was this week's edition of Deconstructing Dinner, produced and recorded at Nelson, British Columbia's Kootenai Co-op Radio. I've been your host, John Steinman. I thank my technical assistant, John Ryan. The theme music for Deconstructing Dinner is also courtesy of Nelson area resident Adam Shake. This radio show was provided free of charge to campus community radio stations across the country and relies on the financial support from you, the listener. Support for the program can be donated through our website at deconstructingdinner.ca or by dialing 250-352-9600.